Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program,
your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from the Radio Row at the United Nations. We're going to have a whole bunch of ambassadors wandering through here throughout the day. Plus, we'll be taking your calls and talking about the news of the day. Plus, broadly, just to give you an overview of the day, we're going to start out with Max Schultz talking about global climate change. Then we'll have the ambassador from Canada, then the ambassador from Grenada. We'll be taking your calls, and Christy Harvey's going to join us in the third hour. So let's start it right out. Max Schultz is with us. Max is a senior fellow with the Center for Energy Policy and Environment with the Manhattan Institute. Their website, manhattan-institute.org. And Max, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's nice to be with you.
Thank you. Cap and trade. Right now there's this the Lieberman-Warner cap and trade bill before the United States Senate. It seems to be stalled out. The Republicans called for a full reading of the bill, which basically means that the clerk is up all night long reading the thing into the record.
Well, I think if I may interject, I think that they called for a reading of the Boxer substitute. The original bill was 190 some pages, and Senator Boxer proposed replacing that with her bill, which is 490 pages. And so they called for reading that.
Right, but the net effect on both of these is that there's not going to be any significant climate change legislation in this legislative session. Would you agree on that?
I think probably not.
Yeah, and frankly, I have some concerns about the bill, you know, that was put forward, in as much as it's got some very, very vague language that could end up being a multi-hundred-billion-dollar subsidy for the nuclear industry, which may or may not be a good thing. So, Max, first of all, Manhattan Institute, what's your position on cap and trade and this whole issue of carbon taxes, I think that
cap and trade is kind of a fundamentally dishonest way to go about regulating carbon. If you want to do this, and I'm not saying that we should, but if you want to regulate carbon, then go ahead and impose a tax. Do something that's straightforward.
Like Sweden has done this. It seems to be working quite well for them. $300 per ton tax on carbon.
Right, but something that's transparent and where the costs are obvious. Cap and trade seems to me to be a sort of scheme which disguises the costs, which disguises the fact that what we really are talking about are taxes. And worse, it seems to put together this, and we've seen this in Europe with their cap and trade system. It puts together a scheme which can be, you know, easily gamed by corporations and industries with political connections. As we have seen in Europe so far, in their experience, it hasn't had any practical effect.
It seems to me then the way you're suggesting is that Obama's proposal that every country, company, large or small, would have to buy the rights to emit greenhouse gases right out of the box. In other words, it is a cap and trade system, but you're not just given credits and things like that as McCain's proposal is.
Right.
Would in effect be what you're talking about. Are you supporting the Obama proposal?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that I think that if we're going to go ahead and regulate carbon, we should do so in as transparent and as fair a way as possible. And the legislation that we see in Lieberman Warner and in the, you know, McCain Lieberman before that doesn't seem to be terribly transparent to me.
Yeah, I don't entirely disagree with you on that. What's your position on regulating or taxing carbon, period? Good idea, bad idea?
I'm not sure that it's the sort of thing we should be rushing into right now. Let's talk about what we know about global warming and climate change. We know that we've had warming over the last century of about a degree. We know from what the IPCC tells us that we could have warming of a couple more degrees over the next 100 years. And it's a slow process.
Which would take us back to where we were 600,000 years ago before humans emerged.
Right. I mean, it's one of the things.
It may be a world hostile to our species.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. But I mean, you know, one of the other things we know about climate change is that the Earth has at various times, you know, heated and cooled, you know, long before mankind was burning fossil fuels. There are natural cycles
And there have been five great extinctions where over 90% of all, you know, mammals larger than 2 pounds died on the planet. Are we sure that, you know, just because these things happen naturally, that it's a good thing for us to be precipitating this? I mean, arsenic is a natural substance. We don't take it, you know, saying, hey, it's organic.
But do we think that if temperatures rise a couple degrees gradually over the next 100 years, that's going to lead to mass extinctions and to the end of humanity?
Yes, I would submit that it already is. You have you know, over 90% of all the large fish in the ocean are gone, although you know much of that is overfishing. But there are some concerns that at the bottom of the food chain things are changing. You've got large land mammals changing, dying off. You've got habitat, you know, being wiped out. The desertification is growing. You've got glaciers that are melting and no longer going to be feeding rivers that are supplying not just water to humans but to a lot of other species.
Well, I'll say that.
It's just getting underway now.
Well, but the connection between the warming that we've seen over the last century to that is to my mind, extraordinarily spurious. And let me just say one thing about the projections that the IPCC has said for the next century. They're based on all these very elaborate computer models with many different variables and factors thrown in. And it seems to me that if we're going to believe that this is that these projections are correct, and I think that we should approach this with some skepticism. I think we have to.
Well, wait a minute. Why approach it with skepticism when in '98 they said that their '95 projections were far too conservative and things were going faster than they thought? In 2002 they said their '98 projections were too conservative, and now they're saying, hey, things are going even faster than we thought in 2002.
Well, I guess
I mean, every step along the way, the IPCC has been saying it's going slower than it actually is.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about the modeling is that the models have failed to see exactly what's happened over the last decade. You know, we actually haven't seen warming over this last decade. And I think the article in Nature magazine last month, which says that we probably aren't going to see warming over the next decade. Now, these models have utterly failed to predict this sort of thing, which is happening right now.
Have failed to predict that in 11 of the last 12 years are the warmest in history, that the severe weather events are spiking over the last decade in ways that hasn't been seen. And it seems to me that these models are fairly accurate in their predictions, if not too conservative.
Well, I think I would probably disagree with you on that. But let's talk about these extreme weather events that we see. You know, one of the best examples was the hurricanes that we had in the Gulf of Mexico a couple of years ago. And a lot of people pointed, there's so much emotionalism in the climate change debate, and people pointed to these and said, see, this is evidence of global warming happening right now. Then the next year, when there were all these predictions that we're going to have a huge hurricane season again, and it didn't materialize, yet people saying, well, you know, the fact that there hasn't been hurricanes, well, this is evidence of global warming.
No, nobody's saying either one. People are saying that there's natural variation. You have La Niñas and El Niño cycles. You have very often a big hurricane season because those hurricanes dump a lot of cold water into the warm waters of places like the Gulf of Mexico. Make it so that over the next year or two, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to have severe hurricanes. I mean, this isn't rocket science.
Okay. All right. We can agree to disagree on that.
All right. So then it sounds to me like you're saying that you just, you know, we don't need a carbon tax because we don't have to worry about carbon. We don't have to worry about carbon because, you know, the human effect on global warming is insignificant. Is that your point?
Well, it's not entirely clear to me how significant humans' impact on global warming is. You know, we know that there are natural variabilities in the oceans, and we also know, and this is one of the things which comes through fairly clearly in the IPCC reports, that we have close to no understanding of how the sun and its sunspot activity affects the Earth's temperature. You know, that is.
Sure, of course. There's 24,000 year cycles,
and it affects the Earth's temperature. These are processes which we don't understand.
But is that a reason for us to take the carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere? We're up to 385 parts per million right now. We were in the 260 region at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. We haven't crossed 350 parts per million in over 600,000 years. Isn't that a little concerning to you? I mean, aren't you concerned about your children or other people's children and their children, the future generations?
Yes, Tom. I'm concerned about my children and the children that I hope that they will have. But if I were convinced that this is something which is leading us to calamity, I would be. But I'm not.
I mean, if you were seeing a spike in the level of arsenic or mercury in your bloodstream and you didn't have symptoms yet, wouldn't you be concerned about that?
Tom, it seems to me that there are that the world has plenty of problems which are far more pressing and which demand and which truly do demand urgent action compared to dealing with global climate change.
Far more pressing. I was just on the border of Darfur in southern Sudan a couple of weeks ago. A large part of what's driving that conflict there is that the desert is moving south in Central Africa.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to go.
Yeah, you're going to say it's natural variability. It may be. Max, I appreciate your coming on the show.
Happy to be with you.
And mixing it up with me. It's been an interesting conversation. Max Schultz, he's a senior fellow at the Center for Energy Policy and Environment, Manhattan Institute, manhattan-institute.org is their website. Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Business like the oil business.
Congress, Mr. Swell. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well.
We have with us, by the way, welcome back. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live from the United Nations today. And we have with us Canadian Ambassador John McNee. And Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm so pleased you could drop by. Canada, I just had a conversation with a fellow from the Manhattan Institute who was arguing essentially that climate change is just part of a natural sunspots or something. And it seems that, you know, whether or not, I don't know if Canada has an official position on this. I'm curious your thoughts, your statement on that, as it may be. But also, the Arctic seems to be opening. People are competing for shipping lanes. The Soviets went out and dropped a little flag in the water and said, ha-ha, this is ours. What's going on with all this, and what's Canada's position on it?
Well, Tom, I think that the first thing on climate change is to take a close look at the reports of the UN panel, which includes 3,000 scientists worldwide. It keeps reporting, and each time in starker and more substantiated ways, about the impacts of the fact that climate change is occurring.
Right.
And we see it in Canada most dramatically in the Arctic, where traditional lifestyles and patterns of the Inuit in the north and others in the north are being affected, and that's real and that's happening. So,
and these are people who have been there, presumably, according to the best archaeology, somewhere between 10 and 30,000 years.
Right.
Continuously.
So I think that it's pretty well accepted in Canada that climate change is happening.
Yeah, and that man-made activity is a significant driver of it.
Yeah.
So what is Canada doing about this?
Right. Well, it's an important issue for Canada. The Canadian government has just introduced very stringent legislation obliging the major industrial sectors to take action. And so I think our government's approach is first to try and domestically put our house in order, take measures that will be effective to turn the trend around in Canada. So that's one thing which is hugely important.
By obliging, do you mean things like carbon taxes? I mean, is there a stick along with a carrot?
There are sticks. A carbon tax has been introduced by one of our provinces, like the United States, Canada's a federal system.
Right.
And there are some interesting parallels. There's a lot of activity at the provincial level. The province of British Columbia has introduced a carbon tax.
Successfully? I mean, it's in the law?
It's in the law as of a couple of months ago. So it'll take a couple of years to pan
just
out.
Just like Sweden has recently.
Yeah.
So
we'll see how that works. But the federal government's legislation is obligatory. It has penalties for noncompliance and is serious. So I think that's one important thrust. The second one is active participation in the post-Bali, the global negotiations to reach an accord, because from the environment's point of view, well, so I should say that that's hugely important to us, and the Canadian government has said, you know, Canada will do its part. The industrialized economies have heavy responsibilities, but also the emerging economies have got to be part of the solution and have to contribute and make a real contribution. Because, you know, in layman's terms, and I'm not a scientist, but from the environment's point of view, the greenhouse gases, the environment doesn't care where they come from, it's the effect. So,
And yet Canada is one of the major suppliers of oil, not just to Canada, but to the
United States.
And you know, the coal, the shale, the coal tar sands, I guess, in Alberta and whatnot.
Do you see Canada not just restricting the use of carbon and the emitting of carbon, as you've been talking about here, but also is Canada aggressively moving in the direction of non-carbon energy-producing technologies?
Well, a couple of points on the energy policy. I would describe Canada as as almost an energy superpower. I mean, we have such a multiplicity of sources. We're, in fact, the single biggest supplier of oil to the United States,
right,
and a secure supplier, and that will continue. Hydroelectric power is exported to this country. We have coal, we have nuclear, we have hydro, we have a lot. We're trying hard to find new technologies, but I think almost more important in parallel is putting money into carbon capture and storage projects based on natural gas in Canada. Stringent regulations of the tar sands developments, as to, you know, what they can emit, what they can do. That's the way we're going. I think realistically, countries like Canada, the United States, are not going to overnight be able to go to innovative energy supplies. The problem is much too vast for that, so that part of the solution has to be living with the kinds of sources of energy we have now, but making them cleaner and greener as you go along.
Meanwhile, we're seeing a worldwide food crisis.
Right.
I was on the border with Darfur a few months ago, and it's they're literally living on what the UN World Food Program is bringing in.
Right.
And the World Food Program itself is facing an economic crisis.
Yeah.
What is Canada doing with regard to the world food crisis? And what are your thoughts on this? And what's the UN doing for that matter?
Well, it's a very serious worldwide problem, but one which I think is capable of solutions. What Canada's approach is severalfold, but our immediate response to the situation which the World Food Program faced was to up our contribution by $50 million because, of course, the rise in food prices meant that the monies they had didn't go far enough.
That's great. That's 10% of their shortfall.
Well, Canada and the United States have been two of the biggest contributors to the World Food Program since the beginning of time. But, Tom, almost more important is the Canadian government has taken a decision no longer to oblige the World Food Program to draw on Canadian supplies of food. So in the lingo, it's untying that aid. So we just give them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
6:6, 3:03, 22:70. So, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. No, democracy means we're working together in this world to make it a better world, a better country, a better place for, you know, the survival of not just the human species, but all of them. We've been talking a lot about climate change today. There are some stark differences in the way the issue is being approached in the United States, although, interestingly, in this presidential campaign, both candidates are acknowledging that there is climate change, which I find fascinating. Although John McCain and Barack Obama's approaches to it are very different. And I have with me Dr. Angus Friday. He is the ambassador to Grenada, or from Grenada to the United Nations. And Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on, Tom.
Very pleased to have you with us. I'm not going to drag you into U.S. Domestic politics. I know that that's, I'm guessing anyway, that that's probably something that as an ambassador you would not, that's not where you would want to go in any case, but you are the chairman of the Alliance of Small Island States.
Indeed.
And Grenada is a country that will be probably and may already be being, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, disproportionately affected by climate change, sea level change, severity of storms, all the things associated with climate change. What are your What are your thoughts? What's the state of things right now from your point of view, from your country's point of view?
Sure. Well, Grenada is pleased to be heading up the Alliance of Small Island States, and this is a group of some 37 island states from around the world, including the Pacific Islands and the Indian Ocean, around Africa, and indeed the Caribbean. And for some 20 years, we've really been the trumpeting the issues of climate change and why the world ought to do something about it. From Grenada's point of view, we certainly had the opportunity to experience climate change firsthand. Prior to 2004, Grenada was considered to be below the hurricane belt. In 2004-2005, we had two successive hurricanes within 10 months of each other.
Hmm.
And that...
This is unprecedented?
Unprecedented. And the damage that wrought on the island, 200% of GDP, or about $800 million worth of damage.
200% of GDP? 200%. For the United States, that would be the equivalent of $18 to $20 trillion
of
damage.
You can't even imagine it.
The entire country being wiped out, essentially, economically.
90% of our homes were destroyed on the island as a result of the hurricane. So we in Grenada certainly have a first-hand knowledge of the impacts of climate change, as do a number of our colleagues from island states from around the world, in the Pacific, who are feeling the impacts of sea level rise, for instance, other islands in the Caribbean and other places where we're seeing hurricane and cyclone activity where we haven't seen it before. So climate change is not some distant possibility. It's a reality for many of us.
So when you hear American politicians, or for that matter, representatives of think tanks or corporations, suggesting this is just sunspot activity, these are just normal variations, don't worry, be happy, or there's a real problem here, this has to do with carbon dioxide and associated carbon-based, you know, methane and other gases getting in the atmosphere, therefore let's go with, on the one hand, so-called market-based solutions. Let's just leave this up to the big corporations. We'll provide them some incentives, perhaps, you know, cap and trade kind of thing, versus, damn it, we're going to do something, you know, like Sweden imposing a $300 a ton tax on carbon, period. This is, you know, end of discussion. We're going to do something. Does the Alliance of Small Island States, for that matter, does the U.N., I guess the IPCC speaks to this issue for the U.N., but,
sure,
you know, how do you respond to those kind of things? Thoughts and professional thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to refer to the science that's been developed by the IPCC, over 2,000 scientists from around the world, and the reports that they've put out in terms of the impacts of climate change. So there's no question that climate change is a result of anthropogenic or human activity.
Right. This is a major driver of it.
The major driver. I think a second driver to the whole issue has been what we call the Stern Report, which is a report that came from Sir Nicholas Stern, who was the chief economist at the World Bank, now tied to the London School of Economics. But what he pointed out in his report, which came out at the end of 2006, was that it's going to be better for us to deal with climate change today as opposed to if we wait, because the cost of dealing with it later on is going to be so much more. So there was a bit of a carrot and stick, if you like, within that. Now, what needs to be the global response to it in order to do things quickly enough? I think what has been more palatable to date has been the sort of cap and trade and market-based systems. But at the end of the day, as far as the island states are concerned, while we think that this is an important step in the right direction, there can be no question that we also need to look at other mechanisms, mandated policy mechanisms, to bring about rapid change. You know, this idea that somehow the markets... there's some natural law that markets can sort things out. certainly isn't the case. When we look at the food crisis we're seeing today, we can see what markets can
typically
do.
Over the long term, you can make an argument for that. But in the middle, there is a whole lot of damage that gets done to people as these things stabilize themselves.
Absolutely. My personal preference would be to see much more mandatory policy activity around reducing carbon emissions, and that could be done through some taxing systems, with a view that eventually trading mechanism will come into full effect.
Right.
I think it's useful that we have started a trading mechanism, but I think we need to look at much more profound measures that can sort the problem out.
We're talking with Ambassador Angus Friday of the country of Grenada, and also the chairman of the coalition, the alliance, excuse me, of small nation states, island nation states. And the United Nations has, contrary to the histrionics and hysterics of many conservatives in the United States, has relatively limited power in the world. I mean, the United States has a bully, or the United Nations has a bully pulpit. With regard to peacemaking, there is some significant power. It was created as a as an instrument of world peace. It wasn't created as an instrument to save species, or for that matter, to save humanity in the event of something other than, you know, a Hitler-like maniac. If my understanding is correct, if you would disagree with that, I'd. But broadly,
I would broaden what you've said.
Okay. Well, I think over time the mandate in the many areas that the UN has become involved in have been extraordinary, admirable, and I salute them. But by and large, they're not areas where there is actual power. The UN has the ability to send in peacekeeping forces to a nation that may not even want them in some cases, or inspectors into a nation that may not even want them. They can't go into a nation that doesn't want them and say,
sure,
you will stop emitting carbon.
Sure.
You
sure
will protect the elephants or the polar bears, that kind of thing. And so to what extent can the UN be a catalyst for the kinds of changes that you're talking about beyond its role that has been played so well by the IPCC and you know, the many nations that are speaking out for these kinds of changes? Because by and large, it seems like, you know, China, India, and the United States, the largest, the most profligate, let's say, of the polluters, and certainly the largest, I believe, as well, but Europe is right up there, but they're, you know, they're using what, once they're producing 1/7 per person per capita of what the United States is in terms of carbon. To what extent can the UN play a role in making this kind of change happen?
Well, I think the UN has an important role to play. We've already seen what the UNFCCC, that's the United Nations Framework Convention for Climate Change, and the impact that that is having in at least convening countries to talk about the problem. And that certainly is an important step. But when you consider that climate change and global warming has been around, you know, we've known of it since, you know, the 1970s, when you consider that, you know, in 1990 we had the Rio Convention, for example, and you ask yourself, well, what has actually happened since then? You begin to see some of the limitations of what we call the intergovernmental process. And what I see as the severe limitation of the intergovernmental process is that you're basically trying to agree things by consensus, and there's always a danger that you end up with the lowest common denominator in
right
terms of an agreement. And I think if we were to see more impacts on low-lying countries such as Bangladesh and the Nile Delta, for example, if we were to start seeing more impacts on the island states, then the United Nations would have failed in its mandate. So as far as we're concerned in the island states, the survival of the islands needs to be the fundamental benchmark against which the
And you think that rises to the level of, no pun intended, that rises to the level of activating the actual inherent powers in the UN Charter of the United Nations to say to states, you will do this?
I can't say whether we will get to that point. Certainly once we have a new framework agreed to in by the end of 2009, we need to ensure that we have the sticks and carrots in place that allow us to do that.
Fascinating. Ambassador Angus Friday, he is the chairman of the Alliance of Small Nation States, and of course the ambassador from the great country of Grenada, our neighbor and friend. And thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you very much, Tom. Great pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. It is 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
The Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
breaking news, the secretary, the chief of staff of the Air Force just resigned. By the way, Barack Obama and the DNC, Howard Dean, have issued a joint announcement that they will take no money from lobbyists or PACs. The DNC itself will not take any. There's a lot going on here. And also, as Jay Rockefeller, talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee, has finally gone on record saying that the Bush administration misused and in some cases disregarded intelligence which led the nation into war. Jay Rockefeller said, quote, and this is the senator who is on the Senate Intelligence Committee, the senator from West Virginia, in making the case for the war, the administration repeatedly presented intelligence as fact when in reality it was unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent. As a result, the American people were led to believe that the threat from Iraq was much greater than actually existed. One of the groups that was checking out that threat and doing, I thought, an admirable job until they were pulled out of Iraq by George W. Bush so he could begin his bombing campaign, was the International Atomic Energy Agency, otherwise most often referred to as the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, you may remember. And Tracy Brown is the liaison and public information officer. We're broadcasting live from the United Nations today, and she just wandered by, and this is a great opportunity to talk with you. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you.
The program. And thanks so much for being with us. What's the IAEA up to right now? And in particular, what's it up to with regard to Iran and North Korea? These are the areas that we're hearing so much either hysteria or legitimate concern about in our press.
Well, currently this week our Board of Governors is meeting to discuss a number of topics which you've mentioned, Iran being the most prominent. We issued our report on Iran last week, wherein we concluded that they had not ceased their enrichment-related activities contrary to demands by the Security Council. The report also expressed serious concern over Iran's failure to provide more information on their alleged weaponization activities.
Now just to clarify here, in order to create fuel for a nuclear reactor, you have to refine, purify, what's the word that you use?
Enrich.
Enrich, thank you very much. Uranium up to around a 3% threshold, as I recall. And in order to make weapons, it has to be over 90%, is that right? Are you suggesting that Iran is pushing above that 3% threshold, or did the UN just ask them to simply stop, forget it, you guys can't even have a nuclear power plant, you have to buy it from outside?
Well, what happened is that uranium enrichment is a peaceful nuclear technology, however it's dual use.
Right.
You can use it for the nuclear power plant and otherwise. But the problem with Iran is that it engaged in this activity without declaring that it was doing so to the agency as it is required to. Under international law.
Didn't they declare it to the world?
Well, they declared it after the fact, but it resulted in a breach of trust and a loss of confidence, which has led us to this impasse where we are today.
I see. Is it the opinion of the IAEA that Iran is involved in trying to weaponize, as it were, to enrich uranium to the point
No.
that it can be used for weapons?
We do not have any definitive conclusions with regard to that. We are still waiting for more information from the Iranian government.
Right. To what extent is a government or a country entitled under international law and IAEA rules to have a domestic nuclear power program, which would include the enrichment of uranium up to that 3% threshold?
Under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, states, non-nuclear weapon states, promise to forego nuclear weapons in exchange for the right to peaceful nuclear technology. So that's where the right begins.
And Iran is a signatory to that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So
they also agreed to subject themselves to safeguards by the IAEA, which is international inspections.
Right. And have they?
Yes, they have.
So there's a disconnect here in my mind. they've signed the treaty. They've subject themselves to
inspections.
There's no evidence that they're going in the direction of weaponization.
They don't have conclusive evidence.
I see. Okay. So why is the UN saying to them, stop enriching uranium?
We believe that as a confidence-building measure, right, this is the best way to proceed. And it's not we. It's the Security Council which made this demand.
I see. I see. So the IAEA is basically enforcing the will of the Security Council.
We're not really enforcing, because the Security Council is the sole enforcement power, right, under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter.
Right.
We just carry out whatever initiatives they ask us to within the realm of our mandate.
Right. We're talking with Tracy Brown. She's the liaison and public information officer for the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. India is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement, and yet they're enriching uranium. Isn't there a double standard here?
Not really. They have not made the promise to forgo nuclear weapons under the NPT treaty.
Right.
And so, therefore, they are not subject to the same restrictions that other states who have made.
So, if Iran were to do like the United States did with the nuclear test ban treaty or the missile, whatever it was that George Bush in the first few months of his administration just said, sorry, we're going to ignore that treaty, we're going to unsign that treaty. If Iran were to unsign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they would no longer be in non-compliance?
If they were to withdraw, it would be a major problem for the international community, yes. One other state has done that, North Korea.
I see.
And you can see where we are,
right,
in that instance.
Right. How do you see this? We just have a half a minute left. How do you see this playing out?
Really don't know. Right now, as I said, it's being discussed at our board. It will probably be discussed by the Security Council. To date, there have been 3 Security Council resolutions which have imposed mild economic sanctions. It's up for the member states of the Security Council to decide how they want to proceed.
Right. If the United States were to unilaterally bomb one of the nuclear facilities in Iran, what would the result be, the response?
I think there would be outrage. I think ultimately we and the world, in fact, would like a peaceful resolution to this issue, and that's our ultimate goal.
Yeah, great. Now, hopefully it's all of our ultimate goal. Thank you. Very well said. Tracy Brown, the liaison and public information officer for the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back live from the UN right after this.
Tom Hartman.
Exposing the con in conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I find this absolutely fascinating. Welcome back, by the way, my friends. I've said that for years, and now I feel like a John McCain. That's incredible. The DNC and the Obama for America campaign have announced that the DNC, this is the
big organization, right?
The Democratic National Committee will no longer accept Washington lobbyist donations. We're already seeing the culture of an entire political party change as the result of the election of Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee. I think this is just absolutely great news. Increasingly, we will have a nominee who is not beholden to any particular special interest groups and who is making the party not beholden to special, or, you know, an attempt to, in any case. You know, obviously, there's a whole bunch of folks within the party who are just, you know, what can you say? I mean, this is the problem is it costs anywhere from $3 to $10 million to run for the U.S. Senate these days, depending on the state you're from. And so every senator has to wake up every morning going, okay, where am I going to get $20,000 today? But obviously we need to do something about that. But here at the level of the presidential campaign, Barack Obama saying no, not going to do it. And Howard Dean saying no, not going to do it. Not going to take money from lobbyists. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, by the way, he was warned by a judge that he faces the death penalty for his confessed role under torture, apparently, but he may well actually be the mastermind and may well be proud of it, of the September 11 terrorist attacks. He said, and the judge said, you may be put to death. He said he would welcome becoming a martyr. So, see, this is the, to the extent that it, if it had been done right, this is the way to deal with this. This is what Bill Clinton did with Tim McVeigh. You have somebody who kills a whole bunch of people. You don't make them into the Joker or the Riddler or, you know, Lex Luthor. You don't turn them into a super anti-hero so that as president you can be a superhero the way George Bush did. That's tragic and pathetic, and it actually, you know, it turns Bush into the superhero, or it did for a while, but it turns our country into a caricature of democracy. Instead, what you say is, we are a democratic nation, we respect the rule of law, these people are outlaws and criminals, they have broken the law, we are going to arrest them, other countries in the world are going to join with us in doing this, and participate in doing this, and bring them to justice in a way that everybody can agree was fair at the end of the day, so when that penalty is meted out, across the board, there's a consensus, even among people who may have shared, at the very least, their religion and culture, a consensus that, yes, this was the appropriate response. And the Bush administration completely blew this with their illegal rendition and their torture and everything else when it could have been handled so cleanly. I mean, you arrest the guy, you prosecute the guy. As I said, Bill Clinton did this with Tim McVeigh, who did a terrorist act that killed hundreds of people in Oklahoma City. And it's just a matter of scale here. But instead, George Bush knew that if he could make himself into Superman, he needed a Lex Luthor, and so he had to... Well, anyhow, you know my riff on this. So, that's going on. We're broadcasting live from the UN, as you can probably hear the news and the noise in the background. And finally, 5 years after the initial invasion of Iraq, the Senate Intelligence Committee finally going on the record. The Bush administration lied us into war. Jay Rockefeller, in making the case for war, the administration repeatedly presented intelligence as fact when in reality it was unsubstantiated, contradicted, or even non-existent. As a result, the American people were led to believe that the threat from Iraq, was much greater than actually existed. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And a whole lot going on today, including electoral politics. Ken in Hickory, North Carolina. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Tom, it's an honor to talk to you. I wanted to know if you were aware of the latest publication that was published in the Independent London newspaper about the security plan that Bush has proposed for Iraq.
Yes,
that was published this morning.
Yes, I've read it. In fact, hang on just a second. I will have it up in front of me on the computer. Revealed secret plan to keep Iraq under U.S. control. Yeah, I should have mentioned this. Bush wants 50 military bases, control of Iraqi airspace, and legal immunity for all American soldiers and contractors. Basically, what he is doing is declaring that Iraq is not a sovereign nation, that they are the property of U.S. corporations.
Well, I know that by going through a security plan that he supposedly does not have to submit that to Congress, but is there any way to stop this idiot?
Well, yeah, I think that the Independent has gone a long way in stopping this idiot in as much as they have revealed to the public what he's up to. And they talk about in the article how the blowback from this, the most substantial blowback, you know, while there's going to be a lot of objection to it in the United States and in Britain, the real blowback is going to be happening in Iraq.
Absolutely.
The people of Iraq, in fact, here, hang on just a second. I'll share the sentence with you. The terms of the impending deal, details of which have been leaked to the Independent, are likely to have explosive political effect in Iraq. Iraqi officials fear that that the accord, under which U.S. troops would occupy permanent bases, conduct military operation, arrest Iraqis, and enjoy immunity from Iraqi law, will destabilize Iraq's position in the Middle East and lay the basis for unending conflict in their country. He is creating a military state. I believe he's creating in Iraq the state that he wants here in the United States. He's not going to get it. But
I think so. And the other thing is that he wants control of the Iraqi airspace, which means he could launch air wars on anyone from that point.
Yep.
This
yep.
man is he's dangerous.
He is.
We've known that, but this, in my opinion, is the worst.
And we have to keep in mind, Ken, that it's not this man. George Bush didn't do this all by himself.
Oh, I
there is thought. There is a whole bunch of people who are involved in this, just like there were a whole bunch of people involved in the coup of 2000, including, you know, all the guys from Tom DeLay's office who went down and banged on the windows down in Florida, and the five members of the Supreme Court who, as Howard Dean said, are intellectually bankrupt. I mean, we have some serious crazies running loose in this country right now, and this is something that should concern all of us. I would strongly recommend that people call their members of the House and Senate and say, Bush's secret plan that was revealed today about Iraq, we need to put a stop to this immediately. Immediately.
I think everybody might want to know that Juan Cole at Informed Comment has a link to that, amongst other places. So if they're looking for it.
To the article?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
The other note is that Cheney and Ryan Crocker have spent weeks trying to force this down the throats of the Iraqis. Right there's another problem.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I know you'll have Bernie Sanders on tomorrow. Could you get his opinion on this?
I will try to remember, and if I don't, call in, would you?
I will.
Okay. Thanks a
Thank
lot.
Thank you.
Ken. Appreciate the call. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian, thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
That's okay. You know, I'm really, amazed at what's going on right now.
I'm sorry,
and
say that again.
It pleases me, and I'm looking at this where Hillary's supporters are there. I'm hearing everyone calling them angry. They're angry. They're angry. And, you know, and Barack supporters are sitting here going, let's move on. Let's go on. And I'm looking and watching that Hillary supporters have forgotten if they're going to follow her, and they gave her money for a campaign, she's going to vote for Barack. She was going to run against John McCain.
Yeah, I think.
I think it's up to the supporters of our new nominee to remind them that we can't continue this division when this man has come before us and given us something that we all want a piece of. Is that little piece of pie, and I think it all needs to stop. Let's all just say, I'm sorry, let's support this man, and that Hillary, it needs to come out and say, that's enough, we're going to move on.
Well, she effectively did today in an email to her supporters and is going to formally on Saturday. And Brian, and thank you for the call. I'm not sure that the characterization of Hillary supporters, these broad-brush characterizations as, for example, angry, is accurate or even fair. I'm getting an enormous amount of email from people who are long-term supporters of Hillary Clinton saying that, they're signing on. You know, they're moving ahead. They're moving along. And Hillary Clinton is calling for the same thing. So I think that the healing is beginning in this country, and I think it's a good thing. And God bless them both for running. 16 minutes past the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Coming together is what the UN is all about. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm pleased to have with me, we're doing our show live from the UN, and so from time to time, we're taking your calls throughout the day, but from time to time we'll be interrupting that process as some really cool people wander by and we're able to snag onto them. And I have with me Mr. Luis Jimenez McInnes, who is the first officer in the Strategic Planning Unit of the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations. That would be Mr. Ban Ki-moon. And Luis Jimenez-McKinnis, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you very much, Tom. Glad to be here.
First officer of the Strategic Planning Unit in the Executive Office. You hang out with the Secretary General, in other words.
Well, we try to, working specifically on issues that are on his policy agenda.
I guess
we're his policy arm of such.
And I understand that one of the main areas that you're working with directly with the Secretary General is this issue of climate change.
Oh, yeah, specifically, yes. My issue right now has been climate change.
So from the point of view of yourself and of the... to the extent that you can speak on behalf of the Secretary General, you know, we all know what the IPCC has said, and that, you know, the climate change is real. Climate change is being driven, in, you know, at least in significant part, by anthropogenic, by human activity. We had a conversation a little earlier with the ambassador from Grenada about, you know, what kind of power the UN has to do things. And he gave me what I thought was a somewhat, perhaps, diplomatic or ambiguous answer to a question. And that is, at what point does the UN have the power to intervene? You know, we all know that the UN, as an initially chartered peacekeeping organization, actually has the power to intervene in nations, sometimes against their will, in issues of war and peace. But that, I believe, is pretty much the limit of the mandate of the charter. He suggested that the survival of people, you know, Bangladesh, the lowlands of Bangladesh, his other nation states, that is as much an issue of survival as is war and peace, and therefore there is an inherent power in the UN Charter to force action that otherwise states may not take. Now, these are not his words. This is my interpretation of his diplomatic speak. Your take on that?
I think in terms of the United Nations, what we've been working on is, I guess, there are different venues and different outlets for taking upon issues. I think what you've been mentioning, the peace and security issues specifically for the UN, that's been, I guess, the domain of the Security Council.
Right.
With regard to climate change, what we have is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and that's the venue where negotiations are taking place on this. The issue of that's being specifically mentioned of people coming under threat is real. And that is precisely the reason why the Secretary General has taken this upon as one of his priorities. Right. But for now, the issue is being addressed through the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and these are the countries of the world coming together with their proposals of something that needs to be hammered out soon enough when the first commitment period of Kyoto expires.
Now, Sweden has already, if my information is correct, I believe it is, has already imposed a $300 per ton carbon tax period across the board in their country on industrial and even personal activity, ultimately. Canada has done so in one province, British Columbia. I'm not sure the amount, but the Canadian ambassador was here, and he said that that has been a law now for 2 months. You're in the middle of all this. You're hearing from everybody on all sides. You're connecting with the IPCC. You're talking to the folks in the Security Council. You work in the office of and with the Secretary General. Is there a consensus of what's the best way to approach this? Is it carbon tax? Is it cap and trade? Is it cap and trade where people are given, here's some freebies, go out and trade them? Is it cap and trade where, hey, no freebies, you got to buy them to get into the game? Are there penalties? And if the penalties, if countries continue to emit massive amounts of carbon, do we see blue planes flying over and people parachuting out, shutting down power plants? I mean, where is this?
I think you're going to accuse me of giving you a diplomatic answer on this, but it is the honest one. It is the honest
okay.
one. I mean, I've been doing a lot of reading, researching, and speaking with people on this, and I think a lot of people, yes, some will say the carbon tax, what you mentioned, is the way to go.
Yeah.
Others will say a cap-and-trade system where you cap things and there's a market and you exchange, you know, I guess, sort of rights on carbon.
Well, it's already a multi-billion dollar exchange in Europe right now.
Is that or a combination of the two?
Right.
And I think that's where the UN comes into play, bringing the countries together. I think what countries want right now is a legitimate regulatory framework that everybody can agree upon and that there's rules of the game across the board.
So it's sort of like, you know, if a company decides to list themselves on the New York Stock Exchange, there's a whole series of disclosures and transparencies and reconfigurations of their governance that they have to do. And you're suggesting that if countries do the same thing with regard to carbon, whether it's a tax or cap and trade or whatever, that once there's a worldwide system that there's a broad consensus about, then we can move forward. How soon do you see that coming about?
Well, we need it by 2009 so that it can be ratified and go into effect by 2012. But, I mean, what you're
Isn't
mentioning is
even that slow?
Well, that's soon, though. I mean, 2009, it's
2012, though. I mean, that, you
no,
know.
No, yes, to go officially into force. But, I mean, what you're mentioning is right. It's companies actually want this. Governments want this, and companies want this. They want adequate rules of the game so they know where they can invest and where they can go. This is
They want to make some bucks off this,
exactly.
You know.
So, I mean, everybody can win in one sense or another.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, decreasing carbon, increasing solar power, and et cetera, and it's just the whole thing. Luis Jimenez McInnes, the first officer of the Strategic Planning Unit of the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure to have you with us, sir. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls, 866-303-2270. Our number, TomHartmann.com, for our live chat room.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Naples, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Enjoying your show as always.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I was thinking, I made a kind of a lighthearted comment before. Bush and Cheney are so power hungry. Let them run for another 4 years, but put them over in Iraq. You know, let them take over from Iraq.
Let George run for prime minister, right?
Yeah, there are pictures imposed over the nation of Iraq, you know, Bush, Cheney, 08. Seriously, if they get charged, and I think they have committed war crimes, does Iraq have, if they're found guilty, could they extradite them over to Iraq? Or how, you know, what recompense will we make to the Iraqi people?
I don't know if the current Iraqi government is a signatory to the international conventions on war crimes that created the tribunal at The Hague or not. And I'm not sure how all that works. That's a good question to put to somebody like Alan Ratner's brother Michael with the Center for Constitutional Rights. But I do know that the U.S. is a signatory. And so whether Iraq could bring charges or whether some other nation may, or maybe some even aggrieved individuals, you know, families who have had their loved ones killed as a result of George Bush's lies, would have the standing to call for George Bush to be in the same docket that Slobodan Milosevic was in for all those years, I'm entirely in favor of it. I think that that's the appropriate venue. Just as I was saying before the break, that I think that the United States government, you know, tragically the Bush administration didn't do it, but, you know, our appropriate response to 9/11 should have been, let's bring together the world community and the police agencies of the world. Let's find these criminals. Let's have a trial that is absolutely open, transparent, and fair, and let's punish them appropriately. And the world would be with us, as they were the day after 9/11, if we did that. And Sheikh Khalid Mohammed right now, instead of having sympathizers around the world, would be nothing but a villain in everybody's eyes. And I think that frankly, as it becomes more and more apparent that George Bush has committed crimes that have led to the death of far more people than Sheikh Mohammed. And I realize what an inflammatory remark this is.
Yeah,
he is responsible for war crimes and needs to be brought up on charges of war crimes before an international tribunal. I think, frankly, what Mohammed did is not a war crime. It was an ordinary crime, which, you know, in the United States is subject to the death penalty.
Yeah, but the way that the Bush administration manipulated and used the government, the system of government, the Constitution, and our trust as a nation, it would take a lot of integrity for us as a nation to hold them accountable.
It would.
I think that would be the responsible course to bring about healing.
I agree with you, Mark. And I hope that the next administration will pursue these things and will pursue them with some vigor. And I hope that members of Congress will have the fortitude to do it. I mean, I'm not going to get into German 1930s analogies. I was just thinking about, you know, Marius von der Lubbe, who burned the Reichstaggebüge and that Hitler then used as the rationale. But it's really not a good analogy
Well, that's above me anyway, Tom, but I would like to nominate you for VP. I hope they think about that.
Thanks a lot, Mark. Ain't going to happen, but thank you very much. I appreciate the call, and thanks for listening. Oh, my. Vice President. Who should be Vice President? Mel in Kirkland, Washington. You have some thoughts on this.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Mel. What's up?
I was wondering, what about Barbara Boxer?
Barbara Boxer is one of the few people that I can't come up with any objection to. I mean, I can tell you, you know, Jim Webb has made homophobic and misogynistic statements in the past that will come back to haunt him in a bad way if he were the nominee. Plus, he has the problem of only a couple of years' experience. Sherrod Brown is a great guy, and I think that he would make a great VP, except, again, he only has a couple of years' experience at the federal level in legislative things.
Because I think because she's a woman, because she's Jewish, and she can bring the minority vote into it.
Well, I think she would be a great candidate even if she was a WASP and a man. Barbara Boxer's record is solid. She is just a solid senator.
But nobody's bringing her up.
I wonder if that's because she has, you know, taken herself off the table, or if it's because she's considered too liberal, as it were. You know, I think Feingold would be a great VP as well. I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be an interesting lottery. Mel, thanks a lot for the call. It's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out, and I'm very encouraged by the fact that Carolyn Kennedy Schlossberg is part of the selection committee, as it were. Lee in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Lee.
Breathing room. Good.
Hey, Lee. I can hardly hear you. I'm sorry, Lee. It's you, either you're on a speakerphone or your cell phone is dying, but I can't hear you. Don in Pontiac, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Don. Or Dan, excuse me.
Yeah, it's Dan. Hey. I wanted to just mention that I think Dennis Kucinich would be a great VP. I wanted him to be the president, but it wasn't to be.
I think that Dennis Kucinich, certainly at a policy level, would make a good vice president, and he certainly inspired a lot of people around the United States. I mean, there's a mini movement around Dennis Kucinich, much like there is around Ron Paul over on the Republican side. And Ron Paul, by the way, is still in the race. And
Dennis Kucinich is the only Democrat that I would vote for president this election cycle. I think I'm going to vote third party because I'm so, you know, unhappy with both Hillary and Barack. They don't want to really get us out of Iraq. You know, they talk about it, but they still want to keep all the Marines there to protect our interests, you know?
Well, let's give both of them a little bit of time here, Dan. I respectfully disagree with you, but November's a long way away. Alan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Alan. Alan's on line 4. I just lost my internet connection. If you can put him on the air, Chris.
Hello?
Hey, Alan.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to get your opinion on Ed Rendell. I think he would make a good vice presidential candidate. I think he could pick up, you know, some Reagan Democrats, some of the ones that Hillary was going for or had. Strong in Philadelphia. I think he's Jewish. I think he brings a lot of things to the table for Obama.
Yeah, the... You know, I don't know that much about Ed Rendell other than that he is he's a relatively conservative Democrat. You know, that certainly doesn't disqualify.
That's true, but do you think that could compliment Obama, though?
It may well.
Him as a little bit, you know, as the Republicans try to label him, you know, the most progressive senator.
Yeah, it may well, and it's interesting, or they call him the most liberal because they still think that that's a swear word.
Correct,
it may well, because, you know, Lyndon Johnson, oddly enough, was perceived as an extremely conservative Democrat, a Southern Democrat, when Jack Kennedy put him on the ticket, and it was Lyndon Johnson who dramatically cut poverty in the United States with his war on poverty and who signed the civil rights legislation.
I agree. I think he could have a similar effect for Barack in the same way that Johnson did in that way.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Alan, thanks a lot for the... for the tip on that, or the, your thoughts on that. It's curious. Adam in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Adam, you don't think that Bush or Cheney will ever be held to account for their crimes?
No, I don't think they will. And one thing I don't think is it can never see the light of day in a world court, because it forces up the question of who caused 9/11, and I think that's still a legitimate question of what happened to the World Trade Center 7. And I think when I bring this up, it can be brushed off as kind of crazy, but we rush to judge and believe the straight up story of, oh yeah, these guys are guilty, so they should be put in jail. And it's like, well, wait a minute, go back to the beginning, let's see what really happened. And I think that would potentially come up in a world court, and that opens up a monster for these guys.
Yeah, well, I don't think that we know the true story of 9/11, and you know, my own guess, and this is not, I don't even want to call it an opinion, because I think that all of us are so poorly informed about this, tragically, because there's been no serious investigation of this by the people who have the power of subpoena, you know, the people who have the power of serious investigative agencies. There's a lot of great amateur investigation going on, and I don't mean that in a denigrating way. I was an amateur investigator of the Kennedy assassination. We ended up writing a book about it. But I don't think that we know, but I would add to that that I think that right now we have plenty of evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors, of war crimes, actually. I mean, just plain old flat-out war crimes that have been committed by Bush and Cheney. We don't even need to go to 9/11, although I agree with you that it is time for us to have a conversation about that. Jeff in Tacoma. Hey, Jeff, we just have a half a minute here, about a minute before this break. I'm sorry.
Are you sure you can't hold me over, Tom?
can you make a quick point, Jeff?
Okay. I'm a Kucinich Edwards Obama supporter, but there is a way that people who aren't crazy about him can still move him to the left, and that's by supporting Cynthia McKinney in her bid to become the nominee of the Green Party. She needs money to get federal matching funds. She needs volunteers. You don't have to vote for her in November, but if you give her enough support, she can push him on hand counter.
Will she do what David Cobb did and say, if you're in a swing state, don't vote for me? If you're in a blue state, then do?
Yeah, she is very principled. She was an excellent Democrat. She was pushed out by the Democratic Party, and that's why she moved to the Greens.
Yeah,
but she's
a
real principled person, and Ralph Nader's trying to push her out of the process.
Yeah, no, I understand. Cynthia McKinney's been on this program several times. In fact, the last time she came on this program, not the last time, the first time she came on this program was after she read an article I wrote for Common Dreams on the floor of the House of Representatives. And she was physically seized and thrown out of the House of Representatives for reading my article. So she came on the program to talk about it. I like Cynthia McKinney. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
For the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, working to stop the, well, I'll leave the adjectives to them. You can find them over at their site, teamsters.org, the trade deal with Colombia. Teamster.org, it's singular. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. There are some things I know a lot about. There are a lot of things I know a little bit about. The International Criminal Court is one of those. Falls into the category of, I know a little bit about it. Steve in New York City apparently knows a lot more than I do. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Good. You're going to inform us about this.
Yeah, well, first of all, the ICC is governed by what's called the Rome Statute. And the U.S. was a signatory.
The what statute?
Rome, as in Rome, Italy.
Oh, okay.
You can go online to the UN and find everything. the U.S. was a signatory. Bill Clinton signed it. It was never ratified by the Senate, and Bush actually took the extraordinary step of removing us from it.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we are not a signatory to the Rome Statute anymore.
Oh, you know, actually, yes. I remember when that happened.
Right, it was right after he took office.
Right, right.
Took.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It was right after the coup that put him in office.
Right. Yeah. Now, the situation is this. Whether or not he can be prosecuted under that is not really relevant. If he is in a country that either has signed the statute or in a country that recognizes something called universal jurisdiction, there are certain countries that recognize or under their law that there are that basically what's called the core crimes are crimes against humanity, war crimes, that type of thing. If a person commits those, certain jurisprudence in certain countries say that that country has jurisdiction to try that person no matter where they're from. If they're found on their territory.
Here's the problem with all this, Steve.
Sorry?
The problem with all of this is that, unlike General Pinochet, who loved to travel and didn't feel all that comfortable.
Yeah, Bush doesn't like to.
That's right. I mean, he'd never been outside the United States other than Mexico when he became president.
If you recall, this happened to Rumsfeld in France not too long ago.
Yeah.
Where they attempted to, I think there actually was an official, what's called an information, not an indictment, but an information.
Yeah, this was Michael Ratner. This was Ellen's brother who put this thing together.
Right. So, but, I mean, in the instance that he is caught on other soil, he could be arrested and tried under that law. I mean, and realize, too, most people don't understand the ICC. The ICC is what's called supplemental jurisdiction. The International Criminal Court only has jurisdiction over crimes if a particular country chooses not to prosecute somebody,
mm-hmm.
or if they prosecute and it's a sham trial. So all countries have primary jurisdiction over war crimes committed by their citizens, even those who are signatories to the statute.
Right. Now, I'm assuming that even though we're no longer a signatory to the Rome Convention, we do have we are signatory to UN to the UN Charter and other things that would make war crimes illegal.
Right. Here's what the Rome Statute did. It basically supersedes any of the what called the ad hoc tribunals, the International Criminal Court for Yugoslavia, for Rwanda, going clear back to the Nuremberg, the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. The Rome Statute supersedes all of that.
No, but I meant domestically. Is it not possible to prosecute members of the Bush administration who committed war crimes? For war crimes in the United States using U.S. statute.
Assuming they're not pardoned, correct. But there's something else that people don't understand about the pardoning power, and I think you've touched on this. The president can only pardon for federal crimes. So to the extent that any state wished to indict George Bush under state statutes, any pardon that any president might give him or he gives himself, I don't know, if he could do that, but it's never been done before, he could still be prosecuted under any state if a state essentially had the cojones to do it.
Right, and in fact, this is we did a show on this a week or so ago, and I'm trying to remember the details of who it was who was.
I thought it was there was something in Vermont that actually they had made a resolution or maybe
there's a book out about this it called something like The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, and I think it's Vince Bugliosi. In fact, I'm quite certain it was Vincent Bugliosi who the prosecutor who prosecuted Charles Manson,
right.
And he has a book out now about how the prosecution of George W. Bush for war crimes, and he is trying to get in every single state, and not just in the states, at local levels, mm-hmm. where there is jurisdiction. He's trying to get prosecutors like he was. I mean, he was the prosecutor in Los Angeles for the county of Los Angeles. He's trying to get prosecutor, or maybe for the city. He's trying to get prosecutors in those jurisdictions where soldiers have died in Iraq, mm-hmm. to prosecute on behalf of those soldiers George W. Bush for murder.
Right. Well, I mean,
just
to get
plain old
get,
flat out, just for murder.
Issue indictments.
Yeah. Exactly. And if there's enough of those issued around the United States, if even one of them gets enforced, I mean, it seems that this would probably provoke a constitutional crisis. You know, Bush would claim that he has some sort of inherent immunity as the sovereign, as it were. You know, some sort of sovereign immunity as the president of the United States. It would probably end up before
exist.
The Supreme Court. You and I believe that, but the Constitution also doesn't say that the Supreme Court can intervene in a state election. And look what they did in 2000.
Yeah, we're living in very strange times, and hopefully, with the historic nature of what happened on Tuesday, maybe we're turning the page. Let's hope.
I think so. And I think, frankly, today where the DNC has announced that they're not taking money from lobbyists, I mean, you know, there is this purging of the cancers that have infected our body politic, particularly over the last 30 years. But it's been growing for some time. I mean, we are so right now the exact opposite, the diametrical opposite of where we were when Harry Truman, as a senator, stood up and said that he wanted to investigate the Roosevelt administration for cronyism. And Franklin Roosevelt said, good, create a commission, start looking into it. And people went to jail as a result of it. And you know, and today, if a senator stood up and said, hey, we want to look into the crimes committed by Blackwater or whatever, I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. And the president certainly is not going to support it. Steve, thank you so much for the information. Great talking with you. I do appreciate it. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Ted Sorensen coming up next.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Fighting for the common man and the common good.
The Tom Hartman Program. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. 40 years ago today, Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. Ted Sorensen is with us, John F. Kennedy's legendary right-hand man, special counselor, speechwriter, close advisor. He left the White House soon after JFK's death in 1966, joined a New York City law firm, was a prominent international attorney. He advised governments, multinational organizations, and major corporations around the world. He has a new book out, Counselor, A Life at the Edge of History. Ted Sorensen, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be with you.
I'd like first to get your thoughts on this tragic anniversary.
Tragic it is. And Robert Kennedy lived, he would have been nominated and elected president, and this would be a different country and world, even now.
I understand that in 1968, you were involved, at least this is, I've read this in at least one place, you were involved in with RFK in trying to craft a deal that would basically keep RFK out of the race if LBJ committed to pursue peace in Vietnam. Was there a time when that was happening?
Yes, that's a pretty good one-sentence summary. There was an idea which I was a messenger for and RFK was a supporter of, though neither one of us claim full authorship of it, to establish a commission of wise men, including some retired generals and foreign policy experts and others, to examine what we were doing in Vietnam, why we were in Vietnam, whether we were making any progress in resolving the problems and threats posed by that war. And Robert Kennedy and I went to see Secretary of Defense Clifford and told him that RFK would not challenge Johnson's re-election if such a commission were established, whether RFK was on the commission or not, but that if the president refused to take that step and send that signal that he was at least open to a possibility of closing down American involvement in Vietnam, that RFK would run for president, and in a very serious way, he thought he had a good chance of ousting Johnson from the White House.
Right. And that's remarkable that he was willing to set aside personal political ambition simply to end a war. I mean, that's the rare mark of a statesman as opposed to a politician.
That's very true.
I'm curious about the situation with regard to Cuba. Bobby had, I believe, a couple of big changes in his life. The biggest one, obviously, his change in his position on Vietnam. With regard to Cuba, I've talked with a number of Kennedy associates, Dean Rusk, Harriet and Ricky Ruiz Williams, others, who have talked about a ultra-secret back-channel program that Bobby was working with and that Jack knew about, sanctioned, but had a certain level of plausible deniability, to help Juan Almejeda, the number three man in Cuba, and who is now today, I guess, the number two man in Cuba, lead a coup of Castro in December of 1963 if the peace talks didn't work out. Are you familiar with this? I'm assuming that you have some knowledge of this.
No, I'm not familiar with it, and I'm skeptical, frankly.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it may have been so secret that I did not know about it. There are lots of secrets in government that I did not know about. But I do know that John F. Kennedy was, at the time of his death, exploring the possibility of some kind of negotiation leading either to the neutralization of Cuba or its withdrawal from the Soviet bloc, even though it retained a communist form of government and economy.
That would have been very interesting. Bobby Kennedy focused his attention on civil rights crimes while he was Attorney General. There is, and certainly Jack Kennedy was very concerned about civil rights. In fact, I remember the Nixon-Kennedy debates, one of the debating points, and I've played the audio of it on this show a number of times, where Nixon said, you know, the solution to discrimination in the United States is to bring the heads of the chain stores together and ask them to please allow African Americans to sit at their lunch counters. And Jack said, no, we have federal law, and this is an appropriate role for government. In fact, there is now a piece of legislation. It's the House designation of it is the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crime Act. There are literally hundreds of murders of civil rights workers in the 60s, from the 60s and the 50s, that are to this day unsolved, even though there's a fair amount of evidence, because there's no money to prosecute them. And what this bill would do is fund the prosecution of those folks. It's being hung up by one conservative Republican senator who has put a hold on it. What are your thoughts on that?
I'd like to know what possible reason there could be for a hold on it. That's absurd. Unfortunately, the Kennedys, both as president and attorney general, inherited a director of the FBI who preferred to devote the FBI's resources to solving bank robberies, which were a lot easier to solve and pleased a lot more people.
Right, and car thieves.
Instead of investigating murders of black citizens and civil rights workers in the South, which were very unpopular investigations among some of the members of Congress and others with whom Mr. Hoover was very friendly. So I don't doubt that there are large numbers of unsolved civil rights crime, Emmett Till being only the most notorious.
Yeah. Well, the official reason that the Republicans give is that they don't, this is, I think, about a $300 million bill, that it's just too much money. It's government spending, wasting money, et cetera.
Well.
Yeah.
I remember when foreign countries expressed amazement that John F. Kennedy actually mobilized National Guard and Army forces to end a riot and mob disorder on the University of Mississippi that erupted when one black citizen, whom the court had found qualified, was being blocked from admission, and others, they didn't understand how could the United States do that just for one black man. Well, we count a little differently. I don't care if it's millions of dollars, but when it comes to serving American justice and the ideals of democracy, a different kind of scale should be used.
Yeah. Do you believe that the JFK Assassination Act, which calls for all of the files relating to that to be declassified, the Bush administration is still holding more than a million CIA records in defiance of that, according to OMB Watch and the Washington Post. Do you think that they should be released? Should we be calling on this administration to comply with that law?
Of course, that's the law. I think Congress thought very carefully before it enacted that law. I don't know of any possible secrets vital to the security of the United States in the 21st century that relate to something that, a terrible tragedy, but it happened 45 years ago.
Right. So we're almost out of time, but did you create the term weapons of mass destruction? It was in JFK's speech on 9-12-62. He said, "We vow we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction." I was just a curious kind of anecdotal side note. It's the first time I can find it mentioned.
I'm fascinated to hear that. I don't remember deliberately inventing that phrase. I think you're right that it's much more common now than it was then, but it made perfect sense then.
Yeah, he said, "We shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding." Which...
Yeah, well, that principle I do strongly support. JFK wanted the United States to become active in space to prevent its militarization, because the Russians might very well create an arms camp up there, which would terrorize the world.
Which would be terrible, yes. Ted Sorensen, his book, Counselor, A Life at the Edge of History.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy, he was an acting president. Everything's A-okay in the USA, in the good old USA. Everything's A-okay in the USA.
21 minutes past the hour. The tragic anniversary of the assassination of Robert Kennedy today. And just as I don't know what the appropriate term is. Memorial seems trite, but an homage or appreciation. I want to share with you a clip of one of my favorites of Bobby Kennedy's speeches. It's one in which he talks about the true values of this country. And we have so strayed from this since the Reagan greed is good, it's all about money, give it to the corporations era. We have so strayed from this understanding that gross domestic product or gross national product, the phrase has gone through several transformations over the years, economic activity in general, is not a good way to measure the health of a nation. And Bobby Kennedy, this is just so, well, I'll let him say it. He's so eloquent. Here, Chris, fire this off.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonder
in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are American.
That is such a solid and eloquent statement of the true values of America, of the true values of Americans. And yet, what do we get on the ticker? Underneath the, on the scroll, underneath the news channel. Well, here's where the Dow is today. It's tragic. David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Great to talk to you here. Just to let you know, I just want to talk about Barack and the fact that, you know, it's not going to be easy come January 20th, 09, either. I mean, if you look at what, you know, you talk to James the senator from Oklahoma and the climate change, you look at what they're doing to the Senate climate change bill, and they're just obstructing. So we're going to have a lot of work to do after January.
You're absolutely right, David. And you know, one of the goals has to be to get a 60 vote majority in the Senate, as well as a much larger majority in the House. Jack Rice is with me. Jack traveled with me to the Darfur area, to southern Sudan. Hey, Jack. Whoop, hang on just a second.
We'll see if we can get the levels there.
There we go.
Yeah, it's great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jack. And you're also on the air in Minneapolis?
That's right. I listen to you all the time, by the way.
And well, thank you. And you can plug your station and your show.
I work for WCCO Radio in Minneapolis, but Tom and I, we were both lucky enough to go to a couple of different places together, so I've been a big fan.
Yeah, and you're doing great work. What's going on? Here we are at the UN. There's some great stuff that the UN is doing. We got a minute. You want to...
The reason we're here is I think most people don't realize what it is that the UN is trying to accomplish, what they do. We spend a lot of money here at the United Nations, and I'm talking about the U.S. does.
Yeah.
And since we're going to spend that money, the reason that I'm here is I'm trying to understand what they're succeeding at and what they're failing at, too. If we're talking about doing the things that we do on an international basis, we can't do them alone.
And this is why you were wearing the mosquito outfit earlier today.
Boy, yeah, I'm willing to take
Jack
that
Jack was running around
step.
With a giant mosquito outfit.
Yeah, I know. What is. Yeah, that's what I'm doing to make
No, this is to sensitize people to the issue of malaria and mosquito waterborne diseases and things.
I think it was about making me really embarrassed. And by the way, it was very successful. I feel very, very powerful now.
But this is the work that's being done. I mean, the UN is doing some really extraordinary work.
They are, and many people don't know it. I realize that there are those out there who want to be very negative. But realistically, where they succeed, we need to congratulate them. And when they fail, let's make sure they do succeed. Is that what this is about?
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Well said. Jack Rice, thanks so much for being here. And thanks so much for keeping my back when we were in southern Sudan and Darfur.
Same for you.
Yeah, it was great traveling with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour, broadcasting live from the building that, even though John Bolton hung out here for a while, still has its top 10 floors, the United Nations. amazing when you think of that, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. That is the definition of hubris. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Christy Harvey is with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, and also edits Mike Check Radio, MikeCheckRadio.org. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am just great. How's Washington, D.C.?
Washington, D.C. is quite nice. How's New York?
New York is pleasant, actually.
It's good to hear. I'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a nice weekend.
Excellent.
Are you coming down for the Dockers convention?
I am.
Oh,
are you
going to
be there?
I will be, so I'll see you there.
Let's hang out.
Yeah, I look forward to it, and we'll coordinate that off the air.
Okay.
So what's the latest stuff going on in the world here today? It's you know, the Center for American Progress, of course, thinkprogress.org, and other. You've got some. I've thrown some headlines out as we've been going along, but mostly I've been interviewing ambassadors today. So,
well, there have been three interesting big news stories today. The first is a story that's coming out of the UK Independent, and it's about this secret plan that the White House is working to basically keep the American military over in Iraq forever. And it's this plan that they've gotten. It's talking about having 50 separate military bases over there, and things like that. So we don't have all of the details. The Independent UK got some of the details leaked. But it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that story to see exactly how long and how far we stay there.
This would essentially turn Iraq into a Disneyland for the United States. And by Disneyland, what I mean is it would be subject to U.S. law, but U.S. corporations could operate outside of U.S. law. I mean, it's like Disneyland's employees are not federal employees. They're corporate employees.
Well, basically, it would take, you know how we've always talked about that gray area that contractors live in? It would basically institutionalize that over in Iraq. And you're right. It would allow U.S. troops and contractors to have carte blanche in these areas to do basically what they want to.
And absolute immunity. If somebody decides to murder somebody, if somebody decides to rape somebody, if somebody decides to steal somebody's home or property, they have absolute immunity.
It makes it a lot more difficult, you're right, to prosecute for anything. And the other thing that we need to keep in mind is we're just learning about this secret plan, but the gossip and the rumors about it are running rampant over in Iraq, and they're not happy about it. This is not really doing a whole lot for the winning the hearts and minds strategy that we've not really employed yet.
Right, but apparently this may have been part of a Karl Rove strategy or a Karl Rove-type strategy to help John McCain, because if this were institutionalized, it would block Barack Obama from doing what he's talking about doing, which is withdrawing from Iraq.
Right.
And it would force the next president, even if it's Obama, to follow the McCain doctrine.
Exactly. So this isn't something that is this week's story and then gone away magically forever. This is something that's going to affect the next president and probably even the president after that, unless we find out some more details first.
Amazing.
So the other two things that are really big happening, this morning in the House Judiciary Subcommittee, they actually are talking about that secret rendition of the Canadian citizen to Syria.
Right.
And they finally have unredacted portions of the report that exonerated the U.S. for its role in that. If you remember, the United States said, oh, we didn't do anything wrong, everything's cool, nobody got tortured, all laws were obeyed, and the general wisdom was, no, something very bad happened.
And there was a lawsuit, wasn't there, that got
there
thrown out
lawsuit.
As a result of that, yeah.
Yes. So they're in the process still of having hearings on that, and it got a little fiery. The Inspector General is
who's
saying,
the they that's having the hearings?
It's a subcommittee for the House Judiciary Committee.
Okay, before Congress.
Before Congress. And so they're trying to get to both why it took 4 years to get the report in their hands, and also exactly what the Inspector General really looked at in absolving the U.S. of all guilt and responsibility.
Yeah, interesting. The birds do it, the bees do it, your kids do it. Without condoms?
And without condoms. This is a sad report that we've been expecting, actually, from the Centers for Disease Control. And it turns out for the first time in a decade, the plateau or the decrease of teenagers having sex has stopped. And teenagers having sex is back on the rise, yet teenagers using condoms is falling.
And so STDs, I mean, this is one out of every four teenage girls right now has a sexually transmitted disease.
One out of every four teenage girls has a sexually transmitted disease. A lot of that is the HPV that the right wing loves to fight against that vaccine.
The human papillomavirus.
Exactly. And the teenage birth rate is back up. And the CDC, I loved it, though. When they put out the report, they were like, we have no idea why this is happening. It could be the media.
Wait.
And all I could think was, really, that's what you chose to go with.
Yeah, abstinence-only sex education is the rule, by and large, in most places.
Right.
But no, that had nothing to do with it.
That had nothing to do with that steady diet of nonsense that abstinence-only teaches, that condoms don't work and that you can die if you touch someone and all sorts of craziness that they say. That has nothing to do with it.
Right. Now, Harlan, if I can move along here, Harlan Watson... made an interesting comment. The chief climate negotiator for the United States. This is the guy responsible for helping us reduce greenhouse gases so that we as a species don't go extinct.
Exactly. And the EU had pledged for all of its countries in the G8 to reduce their greenhouse gas usage by, or their greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2020. And so Harlan Watson, this chief climate negotiator, went in front of the EU nations yesterday and said, yeah, quote, it's frankly just not doable for us. Sorry, we just can't do it. And he didn't mention that it took until, I don't know, a couple days ago practically for the Bush administration to admit that global warming actually existed. He just, you know, gave a little shrug and said, sorry, man, we're just not going to do it.
Yeah. Now, David Brooks, the wealthy conservative, Ivy League educated, I assume, New York Times columnist, is sneering at Barack Obama as an elitist.
Yes, I loved this story. I thought it was very funny. He wrote one of those, you know how a lot of these conservatives like to attack Barack Obama for being an elitist and that sort of thing. And so he wrote, or he was on television and said, here, look, Obama's problem is he doesn't seem like a guy who can go into an Applebee's salad bar and people think he fits in naturally. And
does Applebee's have a salad bar?
Applebee's has no salad bar. So Applebee's came forward and said, here's the thing, Mr. Regular Guy David Brooks, We have no salad bar.
He's been eating at the Palm Court a little too often.
Exactly. All the regular people, you know, who have actually been inside an Applebee's once in a while, all looked at that and went, what? What are you talking about? So that was pretty funny.
Yeah, amazing. Now, I understand also Scott McClellan's book, which is, I think, still, you know, just they're selling them faster than they print them.
Oh, yeah.
There's word of making this into a movie.
They're talking about making it into a movie. And supposedly, as soon as this administration is out of the White House and the pain of the last 8 years fades a little bit, they're talking about having all of these movie deals. The first, of course, being that Oliver Stone movie, W.
Yeah.
But
when is that coming out, by the way? Do you know?
I'm not sure when that's coming out. I know that they're starting to film soon, though, so that's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
But they're talking about having Scott McClellan's book actually made into a film. So that should be either interesting, fabulous, or will make my stomach hurt a lot.
Yeah.
I might have to rent that like years down the road when I can finally watch what happened the past few years.
Yeah. And Latino unemployment. This is fascinating. Latino unemployment is going up in the United States. It's jumped to 7.3% last year.
It is, and unemployment for everybody is going up, and we knew that. But the problem is Latino unemployment and the average unemployment for everybody else used to be about the same. And since last year, regular unemployment, the average unemployment, is about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
But unemployment for Latinos is about 7.3%. And there are a few different factors there, one of which is, for example, Latinos were overrepresented in fields like construction, which have just hemorrhaged jobs.
Uh-huh.
But the other is that all of the nastiness and all of the bigotry around illegal immigration has started to bleed off and affect people who are here absolutely legally.
Yeah, this is,
as American citizens.
These numbers are unemployment numbers for Latinos are not inclusive of people who are not in this country legally.
Right.
So
right.
We're talking Americans of Latino of you know of I don't know how you phrase that, but.
Americans
Hispanic,
who were born somewhere else, exactly.
Yeah, or whose ancestors were.
Right, and it's even worse with the subsets of Latinos. For example, unemployment for Mexican immigrants is 8.3% right now.
Legal immigrants.
Legal immigrants. Yeah. And, yeah, it just shows that, you know, the nastiness and the ugliness we see on Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly and people attacking immigration as a whole, it affects people, and it affects Americans, and it's really sick.
You know, we were just, Louise was telling me earlier, we were just pitched a Radio Row in September on, quote, illegal immigration, end quote. The Republicans are going to do a full court press. They're going to get all these talk radio hosts there, and this is going to be one of their let's beat up the Democrats and Barack Obama topics.
Right, right.
Although, you know, John McCain, well, I guess he was for it before he was against it when he was for it or after it. And
there's so many things you can say about it, that for him, isn't there?
I just don't know. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and Mike Check Radio, MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thank you so much for dropping
by. Thanks, Tom.
And see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Yep, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Till the end. One is your hero, the other is your friend.
And I'll tell you, among my heroes are the folks who work for the World Food Program. When Jack Rice, who was on the show with us a little earlier, and Rusty Humphreys and Ellen Ratner and I, and Dan Patterson and my son Justin, when we were in South Sudan 2-3 months ago on the border with Darfur in Gok Machar, actually just 15 miles north of there, a week after we left, there were three people murdered working for the World Food Program, driving around trucks full of food, the same as we were doing, although ours wasn't with WFP. So I'm very pleased to have with me a spokeswoman for the World Food Program, Bettina Lusher. She, by the way, has worked as a anchor, reporter, field producer for CNN for 15 years, and also for German ARD television. Bettina, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we were in Gok Machar, and we did our show by satellite phone from there, this is a region that you're familiar with, 300 miles from the nearest road, 300 miles from the nearest electricity, I mean, literally the middle of nowhere. This was a small town of 8,000 people that had grown to be 45,000 refugees with one single well and three large tents, about a third the size of a football field each, with the letters WFP stenciled on them. And these people, literally their life and death, their ability to survive day to day, depended on the World Food Program bringing food in. What's the status right now of the WFP's efforts in the Darfur region and in South Sudan?
It's really tough. It's one of our most difficult aid operations. We in Darfur feed some 3 million people every single day. And, you know, those people have fled the worst violence, attacks on their villages. Many of them have been living for years now in these tent cities. And often they don't even have tents. They just have these little rickety shelters with some plastic on over their heads. And it's really tough because of the violence that's going on there. Our aid workers are being attacked. Our drivers are being attacked. We constantly, every week, get new updates. And, you know, we've had 75 trucks that were hijacked this year. 50 of them are still missing. 36 of our drivers are still missing. We had two drivers that were killed in Darfur. It's a really tough aid operation. But, of course, we have to keep on doing it. But the attacks have been so much that we cannot bring enough food into Darfur anymore. We've had to cut back the rations. We have to cut the rations in half because there have been so many attacks that we cannot get the food to the people.
Now, are these attacks by ordinary criminals, or are these attacks by people who are inspired by the Janjaweed and the government of North Sudan?
Well, all kinds of people are attacking our truck drivers. Sometimes they just take the trucks. Sometimes they take the personal belongings of the drivers. You know, and the attacks and harassment of our aid workers, of course, has grown too.
Mm. This is terrible. Jack mentioned to me that you were telling him about this website where kids can actually contribute food to hungry people around the world. It's like using the internet to generate food.
Yeah, and it's really one of the most brilliant ideas of the last year. And it's not just kids. It's whether you are an 8-year-old or a rocket scientist or an Air America anchorman, you can play and you can have fun with this. It's called freerise.com, and it gives you a difficult word, and there are 4 definitions. For every word you get right, you donate 20 grains of rice to the World Food Program. And it was invented by John Breen, this amazing computer programmer who just did this for free. He wanted that his 2 teenage sons learn more for the SAT scores. And we started in October. He gave this website to us. We started with 800 grains of rice. Now it's 35 billion grains of rice have been donated. That's enough to feed almost 2 million people. Now, and the way it works is that there are companies that advertise on the website, and we get the advertising money, and then we go and buy rice in developing countries, so we strengthen the local economy, and we give it to the people in those countries, like hungry mothers and children, school feeding. Okay, it's wonderful. It's amazing. Play, play, play.
Yeah, so every time somebody makes a selection, the page reloads, the ad reloads, you get the revenue from the advertising being exposed to people. And how many grains of rice?
35 billion grains of rice.
Which enough to feed 2 million people.
It's for a day. And, you know, and think of it. Every day, like 300,000 to 500,000 people play this game. We can see it goes down on weekends. So as soon as people are back in their offices, they play it again. And we encourage
great.
That. The UN is encouraging that people do this during their work time.
That's right. Play a video game or a computer game. Free Rice.
FreeRice.com.
And this is now the property of the World Food Program?
No, it's just out there.
Just the revenue
website.
Is gone.
Nobody makes a profit of it. It's just totally non-profit.
But I mean, it's all of the revenue.
Yeah,
is gone
and you learn a lot about it, and kids learn something because, you know, hunger is such a huge problem. People always feel so powerless, but you can do something. And you can go to our website, wfp.org, if you want to make a donation. Or you can, for example, see what we've done with Free Rice. There's a video on there how we bring it to the people in Bangladesh.
Yeah. Now, the World Food Program is funded in large part through the United Nations. I remember a few months ago reading a news release that you were running $500 million short.
Yes, basically we're facing a real perfect storm. Food prices have gone up for us as an aid organization by some 55% on average since the last summer. And so we were facing this thing that we couldn't, you know, feed the people anymore because the food that we are buying, most of it in developing countries again, had become so expensive. Just one example, we buy rice in Thailand. In early March, it cost like $460 for 1 ton of rice. By 5 weeks later, it was $1,200 for a ton of rice. And so we made an urgent appeal, and the world has really responded. Saudi Arabia came up with $500 million, an unprecedented grant to us. No, you know, nothing earmarked or anything.
Wow. Well, they deserve kudos for that.
They do.
And it's a shame that the United States hadn't stepped up first. As an American, I'm embarrassed. But
they will do a lot too.
I'm sure we will. Yeah, good. I'm very glad to hear that. Bettina Luscher of the World Food Program, WFP.org, and FreeRice.org. Check it out. Thank you so much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders will be taking your calls in our first hour of Brunch with Bernie, and it's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be broadcasting from the Talkers Convention here in New York City. And taking your calls throughout the hours. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.